Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Catherine Whittaker's back. Hello, Catherine.
Hello, David.
Yeah, how's your week been?
Long, but good. Very good.
Yeah. We thought we'd better get Catherine back on because Paris has happened in all the time that Matt's been infiltrating press conferences and talking to teams about goodness knows what over the last week at the Billie Jean King Cup final. So Matt's got the day off. In fact, he's gone to a family event, which leaves Catherine and me to do it old school before Matt Roberts.
I'm anxious about this.
Yeah, I've had to write my own agenda. We've got no Matt available to us if we have a fallout or if we need to ask a question to which he can't reasonably expect it to be knowing the answer to. And we're going to have no stats.
What could go wrong? We did this for about 6 years. I don't know how.
Yeah, 6 years. And It's nice occasionally to have another go and then Matt quickly come back. It's delightful to see you. And you've had some week to report on with Paris. So let's start and talk about that, shall we? Because Novak Djokovic has won his sixth Paris Masters title, his seventh year that he's ended as the world number one. What was your take on his route through the week? I feel like we saw a lot of different sides to him over the course of the week with all the sort of pressure that was on him and then the pressure being released and then the different level that he kind of came up with in the final once that was released. Is that how you saw it?
Yeah, absolutely. The contrast between the Novak Djokovic that we saw in the semi-finals against Hubert Hurkacz, which of course was the match that took him over the line to secure his seventh year and number one, and the Djokovic that we saw in the final was just immense. It was the two opposite ends of the Djokovic spectrum. And for clearly for very, very obvious reasons. Look, he wanted the title, definitely. I wondered yesterday in the final against Medvedev whether it would be one of those matches that we've occasionally seen. And we've seen them at various points, but I think of a couple of ATP finals performances from him where you've always been good at describing it, where he's just not prepared to go to those dark places to win. He's not tanking, he's trying, he wants to win, but he's not prepared to drag himself to those Djokovic-defining places. I wondered if the final might be one of those performances, but actually Medvedev played so well that he was required to drag himself to some pretty extreme places, and he was prepared to go there. But he just went there without the stress that we saw on Saturday in the match against Hubert Hurkacz, which was tough to watch, actually. It was so stressful. I mean, Hurkacz was stressed as well. He had just secured his qualification spot for the ATP finals the day before. So I wondered if we were going to see a completely liberated Hubert Hurkacz. And we did for a little while. They split sets. And then it all comes down to a deciding set tiebreak. And it's just a stress off between the two of them. Yeah, I mean, Hurkacz's forehand can in fact, that in terms of tennis, stress manifests itself for both of them in the forehand. The forehand suddenly starts looking stiff and it starts dropping short. And it was, oh, it was really edgy. And Djokovic was, you know, telling the cameraman he was getting too close and getting irritated with, you know, the distribution of balls and all of that stuff. All of the telltale signs of intense stress. You could see it in his breathing. It was shallow and laboured. It was oozing out of him, the stress, and how badly he wanted to secure that year-end number one. And there was an enormous visceral reaction from him when he won that match and hauled himself over the line. He almost could have done himself a mischief with the chest beating. It was so hard and aggressive. It all came out. You could see the stress lift with that achievement. So the fact that he came out less than 24 hours later and took himself to the places that he needed to go to beat Daniil Medvedev is incredible, really.
Mm. And I think because it was Medvedev, his determination was heightened, wasn't it? Because he's the man who got in the way last time at the US Open. I mean, they clearly get along and they clearly have an enormous amount of mutual respect, but they are proper rivals now, these two. They've got a very close rivalry in terms of matches won and lost. And something one of our Twitter followers said to us in response to his achievement was that it's a classic sort of big three move to win the next match after a massive setback and massive loss like Djokovic had had against Medvedev, that they just won't let anybody else get one up on them in the long run. They'll sock it to them the next time.
And Medvedev absolutely knew that. In his press conference before the final, he was asked about, you know, will you beat him in straight sets in one of the biggest matches of his life in their last meeting? That must give you so much confidence going into this one. And he said, that is not the way it works with Novak Djokovic. He said, actually, this is a nightmare. I've made him angry and it makes him a lot more dangerous in this next meeting. He knew exactly how that psychology worked, and he was expecting Medvedev, the Djokovic that we saw on Sunday. And you're right, there is so much respect between them. And I think Djokovic recognises that Medvedev could kind of keep him young, that this rivalry could keep him young in the game and keep him motivated. You know, he is going to almost certainly watch his greatest rivals retire.
Yeah.
And, you know, The famous one is always John McEnroe, isn't it, talking about how hard it hit him when Bjorn Borg retired. Now, obviously, that was Borg retired young, didn't he? It was a surprise. There was probably a shock element there. But, you know, athletes losing their greatest rivals is demotivating for them, I think. I think Djokovic, on one very important level, is extremely pleased and relieved that Medvedev is there and that he's as good as he is and is as genuine a toe-to-toe rival as he is. Because otherwise, I think Djokovic, once he gets 21, which I think most people think is likely, could lose motivation. I think Medvedev could keep him young, and Djokovic recognises that.
I think he's also enjoying exploring other reaches of his own game in order to get the better of Medvedev, because Medvedev is so similar to himself in approach. I'm a wall. You're not getting past me. I'm going to keep peppering your baseline. I've got an answer to every aggressive stroke. And if you looked at the rallies won, those that were longer, Medvedev was winning. Djokovic was winning the shorter ones. And in fact, he was serving and volleying yesterday and he was throwing in slices and different spins and angles. And I never really thought I'd see the day, although he's been gradually transitioning his own game anyway in this direction, adding more to it. I never really thought I'd see the day where Djokovic is messing an opponent around in order to win. because that's always what everybody's needed to try to find a way to do against him in order to make him malfunction. He's become such a more interesting player in the last probably 12 months, I think, because of that.
Yeah, it was a really tactical performance from Medvedev, from Djokovic. Had that just been a straight-up baseline battle and they'd both just played their A games, I think Medvedev would have won. I do. Djokovic had to do something quite different, and it was very easy, very interesting seeing him figure that out and deploy his learnings from the US Open final, but also try and adapt them to an incredibly slow court surface, really different to the US Open. It's fascinating, actually. It was a really high quality final. Medvedev looked devastated to lose, which I loved. He really looked sort of haggard, sat there in the chair. I think he felt very keenly, this is my title. You know, he was defending that title. And he understands the significance of the rivalry as well. You know, had he won that match, he'd have leveled their head-to-head at five wins apiece. And that would have felt big, I think. You know, Djokovic is one of the scores in his column of greatness, and there are so many, is his head-to-head records against his greatest rivals. Now, I attach a little bit less weight to that than some people do because it's not quite a fair playing field in terms of, you know, I don't know how to explain this. You're not everyone's not playing at their peak, aren't they? You know, he would have a 100% record against Rod Laver if he played him now.
Yeah. But Federer's a lot older, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, I do think in both of their minds it would have been significant had that head to head been leveled. It was a fascinating final. It really was. And Djokovic looked so happy to win. It was a winning reaction that we don't often see from Novak Djokovic. It felt very pure. There wasn't stress relief in it. That had happened the day before. This one he was able to just enjoy. I think a big part of that was it was the first time both his children had watched him win. His wife was there with his son Stefan and his daughter Tara. I guess Tara has just reached an age where she can sit through a whole tennis match. I was very impressed that she was able to do that, with sort of dancing interludes at various points in proceedings. But yeah, it felt like one that he was just able to enjoy in the moment, and that was nice to see, and a massive contrast from the previous day.
Mm. Yeah, there was a great graphic put up by your coverage on Amazon Prime Video, which I think summed up where we are now with him, Djokovic, in terms of his achievements. I mean, I'll just read out a couple of these things here. That's 37 ATP Masters 1000 titles.
Bonkers.
So 37 Paris-type victories. That's first. Nobody ever done that. That's more than Sampras and Agassi have won combined. Just think about that for a minute. Grand Slam titles 20, so he's tied with Federer and Nadal. Year in number one, 7. That's first. He's overtaken Pete Sampras. He's left Nadal and Federer in his wake previously. 345 weeks now at world number one. He's first in that. 5 ATP finals titles, and he'll be in Turin trying to make that 6 next week, and that would take him first in that. Or joint first, I think, because he's tied second at the moment with Lendl and Sampras. And then he's won 86 titles on the circuit in total. So that's the 5th in the Open era. So you would expect him to add quite a few more to that yet. But this does actually, I don't know, I feel that this is quite significant. I still feel to me that the argument ender will be when he wins 21 if the others don't. If Nadal and Federer were unable to add to their total, I think that is the ultimate argument ender in terms of just sort of being the best of them all in terms of achievements. But I do think 7 years at world number one at the end of the year, particularly given that he's done a lot of that when they've been around, is I always used to put more importance on what Sampras had done, winning it, doing it 6 years in a row, which I felt was astounding. But increasingly, I think you have both made the point that to do it over a longer period of time and have to kind of withstand not doing it and then coming back and retaking that position is quite staggering, really. Perseverance, physicality, endurance, and just, you know, even having his own crisis of 5 years ago when he just seemed to, you know, burn out and lose motivation. So that's big.
Yeah.
It's really, really big.
Yeah, and I'm going to sneak a Matt stat into this episode, despite Matt not being present. I can feel the ghost of Matt in the room.
Get it right.
It's from Twitter, so I'm reading his words exactly. But just one more sort of Djokovic stat to throw at you as a testament to his greatness, as if it were needed. Matt says, would it be fair to say that Djokovic has won the very next tournament he's played after the two toughest losses of his career? Roland Garros, 2015. He goes on to win Wimbledon, 2015, without playing a tournament in between. US Open, 2021. He goes on to win Paris, 2021. He says, there are probably other contenders, but just these two examples tell you a lot about him.
Mm. Yeah. No, I think so, and I think I quite like the fact that he's honest enough to admit that the pressure was a telling factor in that US Open final. Ultimately, even he buckled. I mean, he played a brilliant opponent on that night, but all that cumulative pressure kind of did for him, really. And we've seen in very stark terms in those two successive days in Paris the difference between a liberated, relaxed, unburdened Djokovic and the man who got the weight of the world on his shoulders the day before when he was trying to achieve something that, you know, was up in the air still. I just love that about sport, and I love that about this sport, what it does to people between the ears. And a huge, huge achievement. Just a few other things from Paris. What was your take on the Paris crowd over the course of the week? Because the starkness of the difference between last year's closed doors Paris and, I mean, this felt like it was a defiant we're back reaction from that crowd. They were so into it, they were so loving it, and they had Hugo Gaston going all the way to the semis, and they were just getting behind him. But the match that he played against Carlos Alcaraz, when Alcaraz was leading the second set 5-love. And I'd got that match on mute because Matt and I were recording a podcast at the time, and I watched the scores ticking over and him coming back to 5-all, and then I turned it on after we'd finished recording at 6-5, and they were singing La Marseillaise, and it was just electric. And it was really moving, I found, listening to them sing, and I thought, this is going to stay with me. Subsequently heard from people who'd watched the whole set that Alcaraz, they felt, had been baited and was being intimidated by the crowd. And I just wondered what your thoughts were. Was that over the line?
Well, look, in general, I think the crowds this week were unreal. Unreal. The best tennis crowds I've seen and heard since crowds returned, and probably for a long time before the pandemic as well. It was, you're right, there was a defiance, both a defiance and a joy to it. And of course, Hugo Gaston's significance throughout the course of the week amplified all of that. And the fact that it was an indoor tournament quite literally amplified all of that. And the fact that Paris last year was one of the toughest watches without a crowd, it was bleak without a crowd. Even Guy Forget, the tournament director, acknowledged that this year, that last year was blooming tough.
I can't even remember it.
No, you know? It was, oof, yeah.
I guess I didn't want to.
Yeah. So the crowds were extraordinary. I had frequent goosebumps. And I don't think there's anything better than a French crowd spontaneously singing La Marseillaise. So I'm going to find it difficult to criticise the crowd during that match against Carlos Alcaraz. I think it's borderline. I think that will hurt Alcaraz for a long time. He did look in a daze, really, as he left the court. But he also did collapse mentally. He's never had any Davis Cup experience, for example, has he? That
no,
might have
of course.
Prepared him for something like that, to go from playing sort of the start of your professional career with no crowds to within the space of the year, because his trajectory has been so upward, to then end up in a situation like that where you're the heavy favourite to win, and you're in a winning position, and it all collapses around you. I don't think the crowd crossed the line, but I'm a little bit biased because Le Marseillaise. Mm-hmm. And I do think Alcaraz will be okay in the end, and it will make him a better player. But that doesn't mean that I didn't desperately feel for him in the moment.
Hugo Gaston, though, Catherine. I mean, he is all you could ask for in a sort of talismanic, playing in your home country kind of player. The look of him, I mean, he's tiny. And he's just able to...
He's a foot shorter than you, David.
And he's able to just discombobulate opponents who are strapping big people, and he can knock them off the court, and he can angle them, and he can drop shot them. And it's just, he's everything. And I know this is a harsh stereotype, but it is everything that a French crowd would love, isn't he?
Oh, if French tennis had a little factory to produce their ideal tennis player, one that doesn't conform in a very French, we're going to do things our own way kind of way, who does things, you know, their own sweet way. I don't need to be 6'2". I don't need to have big weapons because I've got the best drop shot in tennis. You'd probably end up with Hugo Gaston. I don't know if he can play tennis outside of France. I really don't know. The only two times I've ever really watched him play tennis were at the French Open when he reached the fourth round, and in Paris this week. So maybe he's a Parisian specialist.
Well, I'm the same. I mean, he has had results that have sort of gradually built his ranking recently, but there have been lower rung events and certainly nothing that we've really had on our mainstream TV screens. And I really hope there is more to come from him. I hope he's able to introduce himself to other audiences, because crowds, I think no matter where he goes, if he's able to deliver and compete and take these guys on, people are going to love this guy, aren't they? I mean, you can imagine the Wimbledon crowd and the Australian Open crowd. And
he's probably already being signed up for the Champions Tour, isn't he? Signing a contract for 15 years from now. Would you like to be the new Mansour Bahrami? Yes, you would. Okay, great.
In the absence of that, just because of his age, he's in the next gen finals this week.
Which... He's younger than I thought he was. Yeah, only 21.
Mm. I didn't realise that either. So that means we have our Turin ATP finals field set. The singles qualifiers for the event that starts on Sunday are Djokovic, Medvedev, Zverev, who was dismantled by Medvedev 6-2, 6-2. Tsitsipas, although there are question marks over his fitness, was it a knee problem he had? I think it was, wasn't it? Yeah.
He retired, yeah.
Yeah, and then there's Rublev, Berrettini, Hurkacz and Casper Ruud. So that means that Jannik Sinner and Cameron Norrie have just missed out. Sinner is playing in the next-gen finals as well this week.
No, he's not.
Oh, he's pulled out, has he?
Yes, I believe he's pulled up because he'll be first alternate,
of course,
for the ATP finals, and there is a question mark over Stefanos Tsitsipas.
Yeah.
And
I know Norrie's going as an alternate as well. So you know, you never know whether he might be required at some point. But it's a field that is interesting. I mean, I think I don't think all of it is going to produce humdinger tennis matches, but there's quite a few players that I think are quite similar. But still, you know, it's going to be intriguing, some of the storylines in there, and it all starts next Sunday. Catherine will be presenting it on Prime Video, and we'll be bringing tennis podcasts to you probably every other day, I think, after each group stage set of matches have been complete and then up to the final weekend.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. The doubles is a bit interesting at the moment, and the title in Paris was won by Michael Venus and Tim Putz, who defeated Pierre-Hugues Herbert and Nicolas Mahut 6-3, 6-7, 11-9, I think, in the final set tiebreak. Now, just explain to me the little storyline going on with the Turin doubles qualifiers. These are the teams that are lined up for it, as I understand it. Although, having looked at some of these fields, I'm never actually sure whether any teams have pulled out the way they're all listed. But anyway, the top eight teams are Mektić and Pavic, Ram and Salisbury, Mahut and Herbert, Granollers and Zabias, Farah and Cabal, Dodig and Polasek, Suarez and Murray, Takao, Kravets, and then in ninth place, Polasek and Piers. And you may be thinking, well, I've just heard the name Polasek. So what's going on here? He could be in twice.
Yeah, Filip Polasek is just the king right now. He won the Australian Open at the start of the year with Ivan Dodig, very successful partnership at the time, but then they went on a real losing streak and I guess they decided there was no way to pull it back and they split midway through the season. And Filip Polasek then started playing with John Peers, who had previously been playing with Michael Venus, titleist yesterday in Paris with new partner Tim Puetz. And they've been very successful together, Filip Polasek and John Peers in this second half of the year. So successful, in fact, that their results in half a year alone have been enough to elevate them to ninth place in the race. Now, had Polasek and Peers won the title in Paris, they reached the semi-finals before losing to Herbert Mahut. Had they won the title, they would have been sprungboarded into the top eight. And Filip Polasek would have qualified twice for the ATP finals and had the opportunity to choose which partner he would like to take to the dance. And I don't know Filip Polasek. The only thing I know about him is he's the kind of guy that has openly said, I would like to take John Peers, please. Which now leaves him in a slightly awkward situation of not having qualified with John Peers, but being qualified with the bloke that he's openly said he would have preferred not to take to the dance, which is Ivan Dodig. Filip Podoshek can still say, I'd like to go as an alternate with John Peers, which rather than play with Ivan Dodig, which would be a tremendous blow to the ego for Dodig, surely. I'd rather sit on the sidelines and have a holiday in Turin with John Peers than actually play professional tennis alongside you, Ivan. But I don't know if he's going to take that option. I would be surprised if he took that option. But Filip Podoshek seems a surprising guy, so who knows? I think it's a pretty silly situation, really. I think that you should have to sign up a pairing at the start of the year that you have to stick with for the year, unless injury you could have a caveat in the rules for an injury or illness situation, but I don't think this does doubles any favour. As amusing as it is, I don't think this does doubles any favours, a situation like this. You could maybe have a, if you wanted to, if there was pushback against that from the players, which I suspect there would be, then maybe create a selling point out of the constant carousel and create a transfer window of sorts. The current situation is just, it's as silly as the fact that Tim Poets and Michael Venus won looking, their kits could not have been more different. They looked a mess. They looked an absolute, it looked a mess. You're a team. Name me another sport or event or anything where a team wear completely disparate outfits.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. It's a shame, isn't it? And
very good at tennis, though.
It's been brought well into stark attention when you see them lined up against Mo and Herbert, who are just so perfectly matched. They've got exactly the same outfits, and they're very stylish outfits. And it's just a no-brainer, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's just an obvious little fix for the sport, really. For the code of doubles. And
somehow doubt that Polishek and Dodig will be wearing matching outfits.
Oh, we shall watch this with interest. And we'll bring you the latest and let you know in a few days' time, once we know who's he going to take and for what purpose. So look forward to all that. As anybody who has been listening to our podcast over the last week will know, the Billie Jean King Cup finals have been going on. Matt has been there reporting on a nightly basis alongside me. Catherine was with us at the start of the tournament to preview it, but has been unable to have her take on it all because of covering Paris. So now's our chance. And if you needed just a brief reminder of what went on over the final day, Russia beat Switzerland, but not before a last-minute selection change, which was put down to an injury to Anastasia Pavlyuchenko, drafting in the fourth player on their team by ranking, Ludmila Samsonova. And the Swiss team were very, very unhappy at this turn of events and took no time at all to complain about it in an 8-minute press conference, which we played in our previous podcast, which I do encourage you to listen to. It's one of the most interesting press conferences I've heard in the sport in all the years I've been working in it. And it was basically Matt just asking a few very measured, very factual, straightforward questions and the Swiss team letting rip, frankly, how disappointed they were with what had gone on. Belinda Bencic called it ugly behaviour. Heinz Guenthardt basically said, it's either unfortunate or it's cheating, what they decided to do. We have contacted the ITF and been told it was within the rules, and there's no disputing that they played incredibly well, the Russian team, and both Daria Kasatkina and Ludmila Samsonova won their matches and played incredibly well and played very well all week long, did the whole team. But it certainly left a sour taste, I think, for the Swiss team and for many that are looking in from the outside. What say you, Catherine?
My mouth tastes very sour. I think I mean, yeah, it's clear it was within the rules. That's an oversight in the rules, I think, that I would expect to be changed, as Matt brilliantly explained in the podcast. That's obviously a hangover from the previous format that has left this little loophole. So it's within the rules, therefore it's not officially cheating. But for me, that's semantics. That's just the label that you put on it. They didn't officially cheat. Now, I'm not questioning Pavlyuchenkova's knee injury. I'm talking about the timing here. And we will never categorically know or be able to prove, it seems, that the timing was engineered with that rule in mind. It is possible that it wasn't. However, that seems like the significantly less likely scenario to me. So everything I say here is obviously caveated with that assumption. I think it was wrong. I think it was wrong and dastardly, and assuming that's what happened, a clearly deceitful manipulation of the rules for unfair gain. And it makes me feel really sad and sour. I completely sympathise with the Swiss team. I know there will be people out there that say it's within the rules, that you can't be expected as sports people to not take advantage of every possible outlet available to you to win within the rules, and you shouldn't be judged harshly so long as you are obeying those rules. For me, I think it's fine to take a moral judgment on things, rules or no rules. And I think morally, it's not right. It's not right. And I think it's a really sad way to end something. But then maybe that's why I'm not an elite athlete, because I wouldn't be prepared to do absolutely anything to win. Maybe that's not why I'm not an archery gold medalist. And maybe that's a sporting mindset that I'll never understand. You know, I do accept that. I it's clear that there was no rule broken, and for some and that will sit differently for some people than to others. But for me, that's semantics, really, and it was wrong.
Okay, it was a hell of a week and quite a way to end it. I mean, what did you think listening to the actual show and the press conferences themselves? Because, I mean, Russia did defend themselves, but I didn't feel like it took such a long time. We didn't even include the audio of them trying to get to the point where they said when they'd submitted the requirement for a change. But, I mean, in terms of just an experience of listening to those press conferences, it's quite something.
Oh yeah, kind of heart pounding. It was really, really exhilarating stuff. Obviously, brilliantly conducted by Matt, and edited and covered and brilliantly explained by Matt as well. Quite a complicated situation. You both absolutely triumphed. I mean the Russians said in the press conference, didn't they, that it was when Pavlyuchenkova practiced that morning, that it became clear that she wasn't able to play. Well, as Matt explained, you know, he checked what time they were down to practice, and that was not within the hour before the match. So unless something highly unusual happened, they kind of have stitched themselves up with that admission, I think. And it would be highly unusual for a practice to be in the hour immediately before a match or a tie. So, yeah, goodness me, drama though.
Drama.
So I loved the exhilaration in Matt's voice. It's the drama, Mick. I just love it. Matt was that gif in real life.
Amazing. So anyway, the tour moves on to this week, and this week is quite hard to follow in terms of what's going on because there's an awful lot. Let me just run you through very quickly where we stand for this week on the tennis circuit, because Linz begins today. That's a WTA 250 event that Emma Raducanu is the top seed in. Stockholm on the ATP Tour begins today. Andy Murray's in that, and it's a very, very strong field. The Next Gen Finals starts, I think, today or tomorrow. In Milan, okay. And that's got a field of Carlos Alcaraz, Seb Korda, Lorenzo Musetti, Brandon Nakashima, Juan Manuel Cerúndolo, Sebastian Baez, is that right?
Yeah, I've got nothing on him. I think he's qualified. Okay. I think he's one that's been on the Challenger circuit and is qualified, yes, by virtue of that. I think it's okay for us to not know anything about him, is what
I
I'm
just
saying.
Want to be able to pronounce it right, because I'm sure when Matt returns, between the two of you,
we'll get it all straight.
He's an Argentine, so I'm going with Baez. I don't know.
No. South American Spanish, they don't do the th.
Oh, great. There was me thinking I got some massive triumph. Right.
Okay. I don't know if that holds across the board for even Z's at the end of a name. Okay. Anyway, we will clarify.
Let's interrupt Matt's family event and find Holger Vitus Nodskov Roon, also known as Holger Roon, and Hugo Gaston. Those are your players in the Next Gen Finals in Milan that starts tomorrow. And I mean, so that's enough already as it is, really, isn't it? Two tour events plus a Next Gen Finals. And then the WTA Finals this year starts this week, but on a Wednesday. So it's all happening. And then so that will get halfway through. And then the ATP Finals will start next Sunday.
Mm.
So we've got a lot going on this week, I'm telling you. And we're going to be bringing you some podcasts in order to cover and keep across it all. Let's just go through these events first of all, though. Raducanu's an interesting one, isn't she? This is her final event of the year. She is the top seed, got a bye in the first round, faces either Wang Xinyu or Katerina Kozlova in her first match in round two. And she did a press conference yesterday and talked about her coaching situation, said that she does have somebody in mind. It looks like it's pretty far advanced, and that she's expecting, well, that she's going to have somebody in her corner for the Australian Open, but not this week. She said, I'm basically on my own in terms of a coach. I think she's got the physio with her, the fitness trainer. But she actually said, I think it's really good for me to be able to be here on my own for this little period. Quite interesting that she didn't reveal the name when she was asked who is this coach. She wasn't prepared to reveal who it was yet, but she's got somebody. But it's not going to be, appears, Esteban Carriel, who was on trial with her over the last couple of weeks, from what we understand. But yesterday we received a note that Esteban Carriel, who previously, you may remember, worked with Johanna Konta in her breakthrough years and has recently also been with Katie Swan, the British player, he's now been announced on a trial with Andy Murray.
Which is quite amusing, isn't it?
Yes, with a view to being a permanent part of his team next year, we are told. We've got a lot of time for him. I don't know him personally, but just the manner in which he conducts himself, and seeing him do the on-court coaching with Joe Konta back in the day, I always liked the way he came across, and people speak very well of him. But, I mean, the coaching carousel never ceases to just entertain, and I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? But this year, it seems to be taking up even another stage, and even earlier.
Yeah, season hasn't even finished yet. I mean, I love in my mind the scenario that played out was Esteban Carril was trialing Andy Murray and Emma Raducanu at the same time, and you know, like The Bachelor. Got to choose at the end. I mean, obviously that's not what happened, but I like the idea that it is. I'm desperate to know who this coach that Emma Raducanu has got lined up. I completely understand and respect her not saying, because every, you know, she lifts a fingertip at the moment and it's carnage. So she wants to, obviously, to have manage that announcement and the impact that that announcement will have on that coach, because suddenly there'll be a frenzy around that coach, won't they? They're going to be getting calls and fielding calls and all the rest of it. So I understand her not sort of just casually saying, oh, it's this person, and then that person's life completely changing. But I am desperate to know who it is, and also really hoping it's she mentioned the Australian Open. I really hope they'll be with her for the off season before that as well. I don't see why they wouldn't be. It's just that she didn't explicitly mention that yesterday, but that's certainly what I hope. Yeah.
Stockholm, I mentioned, is a strong draw, and Andy Murray has got Viktor Dorosevic of Norway, a qualifier.
Hang on, David. You can't say, oh, it's a really strong draw, and then list somebody who clearly neither of us have ever heard of.
Okay. The really strong draw in Stockholm is led by Jannik Sinner, who is a potential round two opponent of Andy Murray after Viktor Dorosevic of Norway, a qualifier. And also in the draw is Felix Auger-Aliassime, Denis Shapovalov, Dan Evans, Taylor Fritz, Alexander Bublik, Francis Tiafoe. And by the way, Leo Borg was a wild card in the first round, beaten by Tommy Paul, 6-4, 6-2, with Bjorn Borg in the crowd watching.
It's interesting that they still have a really good draw in Stockholm, because a lot of people signed up. You know, your Hurkaczes, your Norris, they all signed up in anticipation of the race to Turin still being live this week, and that would have been brilliant for Stockholm, obviously, if they were the event at which that was decided. So I'm pleased for them as an event that they've still maintained a good field, in spite of the fact that that was all decided in Paris last week.
Yes, so we'll watch that with interest. The Next Gen Finals, incidentally, has some new rules. I mean, at what point are they going to run out of new rules to try out? But I mean, the existing rules that they have already got or have already used in the past are going to be there again. So first to four game sets and best of five set matches, no ad scoring, free fan movement, live electronic line calling, which it's interesting, isn't it? There's a couple of these that we just now take for granted. Mm-hmm, there is live electronic line calling everywhere. And 2 years ago, when that was first tried, it was this, whoa, listen to that weird sound. And where are all the people? The shot clock is going to be there. Yeah, I know. Shot clock's everywhere. And yet it was appearing for the first time at this event. Video review and towel racks. I mean, the idea of ball kids bringing over towels. I mean, I think the Next Gen Finals has really achieved its goal initially of trying out things that have ended up becoming relevant in competition. That is something it set out to do back when Chris Kermode was there and started this event, and I think that has shown to be a real success. Now, the new things that it's going to try out, let's see what you think of these and whether any of these you feel will end up as part of the fabric of the sport. They're going to try out in 2021, this week, shorter warm-ups.
Yes.
Down from 4 minutes to 1 minute, less downtime, more action. Yeah. It should say less faff, inverted commas.
That's what they mean. I would get rid of the warm-up altogether. And even more importantly than that, I'd get rid of the faff either side of the warm-up. I mean, on what match was it? I think it was Medvedev against Zverev. They walked onto court. Then they immediately sat down, faffed around for friggin' ever. Zverev fiddling around in his bag, taking out a new racket wrapped in plastic. Get rid of that. Newly strung rackets do not need to be wrapped in plastic. And then they went up and did the coin toss. Then they went up and did some faffing around after the coin toss. Then they did the 4 minute warm up. And then when time is called on the warm-up, then there's some more faffing around at the chairs. Medvedev had his head in a freezer grabbing some towels. No, none of that. Match is called, you come onto court and you play your match. All that faffing needs to have been done beforehand. If you haven't got your ice-cold towels, sorry. No. It is ridiculous, isn't it? The complacency of it from tennis really angers me, that you got people tuning in. you know, oh, I'll watch some tennis this afternoon. You tune in and they're watching 10 minutes of faffing around. That tennis thinks it can get away with that in this day and age and retain its audience. No. We need to wise up as a sport.
Note to the ATP and all the organisers of these new rules. Put in brackets everything Catherine's just said, and then, you know.
Well, the shorter warm-ups thing is it's a recognition, isn't it, that something needs to change.
Yeah, no, it is actually. It is interesting. I wonder. I can imagine the brainstorm, isn't it? Go through all the outrages of the last year about various subjects, and okay, well, we'll try and do them differently in the next gen finals and see how that plays. So the other ones are.
Is anyone in the world going to say, "Oh, missed that warm up? Missed those other 3 minutes of that warm up?" No.
You needed that out of your system, didn't you?
Yeah.
Okay. Achieved. Courtside coaching is going to be allowed. So that means coaching opened up from the sidelines. No more headsets, Catherine. I mean, I hope they're going to have these conversations mic'd up.
Yeah, I can't remember whether I liked or didn't like headset coaching.
Oh, we liked it, Catherine.
Did we?
Because, yeah. I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved the
It was translated, wasn't it? That was a very – I mean, that's what I feel strongly about more than anything, that if the strongest reason to have on-court coaching of some description is for fan engagement. And if you're going to have it, but have it not translate to fans, not audible or not understandable, then that is shooting oneself in the foot.
Weren't they required to speak English?
Well, I don't think that's maybe, on either. That's just
no. I mean,
I thought
that I did think that was a bit odd. But I mean, they're going to have to mic these chats up, and you are going to end up probably with the number of conversations that a large part of your audience doesn't understand.
Translated.
Yeah, let's see. So that's the second one.
Or net make cams. Them mime. Just come up with that and I love it.
Right. net cams. Don't really know what this means. Your front row seat right at the heart of the action.
Yeah. I mean, on paper, that does not move me at all. But let's see.
That's not a rule
It's a visual
change,
thing, isn't
it?
So let's see.
Okay. Limited medical timeouts, one per player per match.
I mean,
I quite like that.
I think so. Yeah.
I think that's good. I think that could end up becoming a thing in the future. And then the final one, timed bathroom breaks. Maximum 3 minutes, up to two for change of attire, plus up to two for change of attire. I guess that means up to 5 minutes, is it?
I'm slightly more okay with this at a men's event, but it still brings me a bit of discomfort. The thought of having to, in a big match, do toileting with a time clock fills me with immense anxiety. I would not be okay with that in women's tennis, and I certainly would not be okay with anybody that hasn't changed a sweaty bra legislating for that.
Yes, quite right. Okay, well, we'll watch with interest over the next week and see how that all unfolds. The WTA finals draw takes place tonight. So we'll be back later on this week after the first set of round robin matches to cover the draw and also talk about those first couple of days and see how things are going. Singles lineup, to remind you, is Arina Sabalenka, Karolina Pliskova, Iga Swiatek, Barbora Krejcikova, who's going to have to hot-foot it over from Prague to Guadalajara. That is one heck of a turnaround, isn't it?
I think that is too big an ask, to be honest, with the unique conditions in Guadalajara. It sounds like the altitude is going to be a massive factor. There's just not enough time to adjust, let alone acclimatised jet lag-wise and everything. I think that's just simply too much.
But she's playing singles and doubles as well.
Yeah, I know.
The price of success. Maria Sakkari, Garbiñe Muguruza, Paula Badosa, Annette Contaveit. And no Ons Jabeur, who's decided not to go as an alternate. She said, I need more time to get ready for the new season, which, I mean, I must say, I do understand that view. If you've worked that hard to get there and your chances of actually playing are that slim, if you are feeling a bit under the weather or whatever, I think there is an argument to just think, actually, you know what? I'll leave it.
It must be tough being an alternate. You must feel like the ghost at the feast. I know they get paid for it, so not getting the violins out, but I don't think I would be comfortable in that role, personally.
Mm. Although Greg Rosetsky didn't mind, did he? He came in after one match and won a couple and at the time of his life, he was telling you on Prime the other day. The doubles field is Krejcikova and Katerina Siniakova, and then Ioma, and then Catherine?
Aoyama.
Aoyama and Shibahara, Shea and Mertens, Melikar and Schur, Stosa and Zhang, and Kravchik and Garachi Matheson, Jurak and Klepats, and Fishman and Olmos. Actually, in the top eight were Katie McNally and Coco Gauff, but they don't appear to be making the trip. Somebody said that McNally had got some kind of injury, which I must admit I didn't know about, and I thought she was in the field last week.
It happened in the US Open.
Oh, no,
it didn't. No, it didn't. That was their opponents.
I don't really know why.
I had a memory of them in tears on the court at the US Open. And that was actually just because they lost the final, wasn't it?
Yes, devastated.
Oh, yeah, they were.
Yeah, so there we are. Loads and loads to look forward to. I mean, I rarely feel this, Catherine, but there's almost too much tennis this week.
You rarely feel that there's too much tennis?
Well, you know, I mean, I do feel that, but yet I feel like I can somehow keep across it all.
Mm.
Looking at this lot, two tour events, plus the next gens, plus the WTA finals, with you getting ready for the ATP finals, I mean, that is almost an impossibility to keep across.
I'm stressed about all the different formats and so on at play. You know, it stresses me out when a 1,000 event is played over sort of 10 days and the men's and the women's are at different stages and it's all very discombobulating. You don't know where you are with it all. I'm anticipating feeling like that for the next week. Thanks, tennis.
Okay. So anyway, we'll come back in a few days' time and bring you another tennis podcast, talk about the WTA finals and how all that's going. And we'll have lots more shows over the next couple of weeks. We'll be bringing you shows about the ATP finals and then the Davis Cup finals. Oh, it's all exciting, isn't it? And Matt will be back. So some sort of order will be restored.
That is exciting.
Brilliant. Okay, Catherine, we'll go and have a bit of a nap because I think it's nap time, isn't it?
It is. You read the room.
I read the room. Exactly. An hour of chat followed by a 4-hour nap. That's the way we do things around here. And Catherine's mascot is this week and every week the lovely Zeus.
Didn't I predict Djokovic to win Paris last week while we're on the subject of Zeus and I being a dream team?
I really hope not.
I think I did.
Well, you did Contivate the week before and she won that.
I think we might be on a roll, Zeus.
I mean, you were already top of the standing. So I suppose this is, you know, this is when you're all supposed to sign up to the newsletter and read all about this. Anyway, the details of that newsletter, the link to sign up are in our show notes. And I can confirm Catherine Whittaker, Novak Djokovic to win Paris was a prediction of last
week.
Very
bold
following
prediction
on
from me to go for the world number one.
You got the grand sum of 25 points for that.
Hey, but when you're already in the lead.
Yeah.
There's
I'd
no
have got 260 if I'd have got Casper Ruud right. But I didn't. So Catherine has extended her lead over Daryl in the newsletter prediction. Hey. So do sign up and do tell your friends about the tennis podcast if you want to pass on the word and get them listening. Yeah, I've got Rogue, Matt's got Scousel Mousel, Billie Jean the dog, who is not present in Catherine Whittaker Tennis Podcast Towers at the moment, is sponsored by the wonderful Billie Jean King. Hopefully Billie Jean the dog will be back soon. She's with Catherine's brother, so we're all a bit of a loose end, aren't we, without Billie Jean the dog. Chris Albert Lee is our executive producer. Thank you all for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it, and we'll be back with you again very soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.